The way security threats to nations are changing in the technological era we are in is something our next guest knows pretty well. Dr. Tobias Feakin is Australia's inaugural Ambassador for Cyber Affairs and Critical Technology. First appointed in 2017, his role was expanded to reflect the central place technology issues now have in geopolitics. He leads Australia's whole-of-government international engagement to advance and protect Australia's national security and foreign policy, as well as development interests in cyberspace and critical tech. Last week, he was the keynote speaker, virtually, of course, at a cybersecurity summit in Wellington that was organised by NZ Tech. Dr. Tobias Feakin is with us from Canberra. Thank you, Ambassador. Really good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Real pleasure, Catherine, to be here.
In the structure of Australia's foreign affairs, where do you sit, and are you in many ways equivalent to, ambassadors that that countries post to various places? Where do you sit within the government infrastructure?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So my position sits within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and as you, part of your question was about, What is it? What is the position and, if you like, the credentials I hold? So, yeah, I'm an ambassador. I hold all the same credentials as an ambassador would, except, if you like, I don't have a particular country, one singular country that I'm working in. My remit is global. So, I'm a fully fledged diplomat. And under normal circumstances, in previous times, I would be traveling an awful lot to different countries to engage bilaterally, multilaterally, to discuss some of the really important issues that we're facing in cyberspace and the way that countries, the private sector, non-government organizations and civil society are guiding themselves and others through a whole range of different areas of interest.
Is this an innovation by the Australian government, or are there similar ambassadorial posts in other governments?
If you like, it's a big growth industry, and that wouldn't surprise you, I'm sure. If do a quick bit of history, I mean, there's a bit of irony in it, but I guess the first beginnings of this area of diplomacy you could trace back to around 1998, when actually it was Russia took the issue of what they termed information security and the dangers that it posed to global security to the UN in 1998. So, it's got a reasonably long tail in terms of its history. But now you would probably find that in terms of actual ambassadorial positions, there's around 25 of us globally. But if you add in now the growing number of international coordination positions within foreign ministries, you're probably up to around 50 plus countries that have these kinds of positions. And, that's very much reflective of the fact that cyberspace is just one of the most fundamentally important pieces of global architecture that we now have. And that's been demonstrated no more clearly than in the current context of a pandemic and the fact that we, do so much personally, professionally, online, and it's allowed us all to function in a way. And I mean, I can imagine any of your listeners trying to imagine how, a very difficult situation that we've been going through, what that might have been like if we didn't have the internet architecture that, in many respects, we sometimes take for granted now. It's just something that we just think exists. But, really, these positions are about protecting what it is that we really cherish about cyberspace and ensuring that our national interests are shared and protected in this environment.
It is a simplistic approach, but forgive me for it, because the issues overlap but are different. And can we talk for a moment separately about matters of state actors, and then we'll talk about the private sector actors? Because as I said, they overlap but they are different. When it comes to state relationships and diplomacy and state actors and actions, what is the scope of what has happened, is happening, can happen?
It's a really good question, Catherine. I wouldn't say it's a simple one at all. I think that's a really, really interesting question. And, what have we seen go on over, almost a 10-year period now? Well, what we've certainly seen, firstly, is a lot more evidence of nefarious activity via state-based entities. And we've seen probably, you know, some of your listeners probably heard some strange names of cyber incidents which might ring bells, things like WannaCry, things like NotPetya, these SolarWinds. You know, you hear these names probably in the media a little bit if you know, you're a member of the public and you think, well, what are those? Well, what they are they're a growing body of evidence of state-based actors conducting malicious cyber activity. So if we think about WannaCry, that was a piece of ransomware that affected global networks. It really did, you know, strike globally. But, you know, very high profile aspects of that were taking down aspects of the UK National Health Service computer networks as a byproduct of that incident. Then, you know, NotPetya refers to a piece of malicious offensive cyber malware that was initially targeted at the Ukraine power grid network, but spread globally, took down various different private sector entities, command and control infrastructure, most prominently the Maersk shipping line based in Denmark, which created billions of dollars worth of damage to their holdings. And the list goes on. I mean, SolarWinds, any of your listeners could have a quick search online and see the content of that and the impacts that it's had on the US system. So we see these series of major cyber incidents being spoken about, which is, to be frank, a big advancement, because in the past, a lot of these, you know, a lot of what was going on in cyberspace was kept very, very secret from between states. We've been on a pathway through cyber diplomacy. New Zealand is very much part of this as well, where we, in partnership, talk more and more openly about some of the malicious activities we see and who in particular is responsible. So you have the malicious activity at one end of the scale, and then, you know, part of the job as states is, well, how do we then, if you like, draw up the limitations? Because, you know, the opportunities are almost endless for malicious activity in cyberspace. So we're trying to work hard in terms of shaping, well, what does acceptable state behavior look like in cyberspace? And how do we try and limit that? And we've been through extensive processes at the UN of trying to ensure that we draw those lines. We've agreed that international law applies in its entirety in cyberspace, and then agreed to 11 what we call norms of state behavior in cyberspace, which complement that. And they're things like, you know, critical national infrastructure should be out of bounds during peacetime, that computer emergency response teams should be out of bounds, full stop. You shouldn't attack these things. And that they're common sense measures that have been put in place. But unfortunately, we still see that there are states who are willing to conduct malicious activity, which really, as far as we're concerned, is unacceptable.
Well, who's the we who has come up with that list, and does it include North Korea, China and Russia?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, that's a really good question. So those two elements, one of them was agreed at a United Nations group of government experts, which is a group of geographically dispersed, globally geographically dispersed group of experts who are brought together to get into the nitty-gritty of, well, what is it we can agree to and how? And in 2013, they agreed as a group that international law in its entirety applied. And then in 2015, that a different group of experts were brought together again, and they agreed that there were these 11 norms of sensible state behavior in cyberspace. And so even though it was a small group, that was then taken into the UN broadly and agreed. So, you know, 193 countries have essentially said that this is sensible and this is a good framework for how we should be looking at cyberspace and draw up, if you like, the architecture of what limitations might look like.
I appreciate that that conversation is happening and that others actually are proposing changes as well, particularly China. I want to come back to that, but can we just park with where we are right now and what the status mm-hmm. quo is? WannaCry, I think, the US pointed the finger at North Korea. NotPetya, if it's a Ukraine attack on Ukraine straight away, one logically thinks of Russia. Australia suffered a big attack last year. It hit many levels of government and across many sectors. How directly has there been a statement by the Australian government about who it believes was responsible?
Yeah, no, it's, again, another good question. You're right in saying with WannaCry, the US attributed that to North Korea, but so did we in Australia, and so did a whole group of countries. And one of the ways in which we're trying to create pressure on countries that are conducting this kind of malicious cyber activity is by attributing that activity as a broader group of countries as possible.
So you're naming you're naming names now. You are naming names.
Yeah, and you know what? Actually, that's a really interesting change in the nature of the job that I've been doing as a government official. When I first came into position in 2017, it wouldn't be the case that I could have even said to you what I just did, you know, because so much of this was in the kind of secret domain. But we've been through this process of exposing what that malicious activity looks like, how not only other governments, but also the private sector can protect themselves. But then also saying, and here's who we feel is responsible, and it needs to be exposed. And that's so that everyone understands what the playing field looks like. And that, you know, we are addressing it. So you can talk about particular countries and the activity that they've taken. I think I firstly say, though, with attribution, it's, you know, there's a whole range of decision processes that, that are made in terms of public attribution, private attribution, and, you know, an assessment process that takes place. But in reference to the widespread activity that we saw in Australia last year, I think one of the really interesting aspects of having a prime minister stand up in public and talk about, you know, the extent of that activity in Australia, which, you know, was impacting a whole range of infrastructure in Australia, all levels of governments, and you know, many other entities beyond. I think one of the key statements that that the Prime Minister made there was that, you know, a sophisticated state actor was responsible for this degree of activity because of the sophistication of what was being seen, and that, you know, the really important part of what he said was this is the new operating environment that we're all in now.
Okay. You know, so the Prime Minister, sorry to interrupt you, Ambassador, the Prime Minister stopped short of naming a country while clearly intimating there's only a small number of countries one would describe as that. As often happens, journalists will report what federal government officials believe because they've been told off record or without attribution, and those reports pointed at China, and we know there's a lot of diplomatic issues with China at the moment. I guess what I'm coming to is, what is the strategy right now? Your defence minister came out last year as well in September and said the cyber attacks on Australia are blurring the lines between peace and war. This gets to the nub of the matter, really. They're not just about... It's not just about what we would describe as a war between nations, but the various conflicts that typically would have played out differently but are now being conducted via cyber warfare. Can you pick up on that statement the Defence Minister made and what countries, plural, are doing about attacks that are going beyond being irritating and annoying, and if not controlled, are coming close to being acts of war? For example, taking out a country's hospital operating systems, attacking key utilities that could end in loss of life, are clearly at point of being acts of war. Where are countries at in responding to this right now?
Look, that's a really, really good question. Without putting words into my defence minister's mouth, what we're talking about in terms of, if you like, that the tipping balance is well, I mean, essentially what we've seen, you know, I've been looking at cyber issues in the strategic context for over 20 years now. It kind of frightens me to realise that's how long it's been. And What we've seen is essentially the realization that there's great advantage to be had from exploiting the connectivity that's brought us so many, you know, awesome outcomes as a society, you know, whether it be for our economy, our populations to be able to communicate globally, and all of the things that, you know, everyone enjoys in the online space. That has also been realized that that is an opportunity for exploitation by states. And what we have seen is if you like, just the growth in the exploitation of that environment for various purposes, whether it be for crime, whether it be for intelligence gathering, whether it be for interference in other states' activities. And I think, you know, the legal discussion that I've been referencing is how we're, if you like, walking through where we place limitations on what states should or should not be allowed to do. And yes, certain states are testing the boundaries of what others are willing to accept. And what we've been through over the last, well, certainly the time that I've been in this position, is as a community of concerned countries. And that, I would say, is more, if you like, the like-minded states and, you know, like-minded as a group. What does that mean? It means, you know, Western states, essentially, from the EU to ourselves, New Zealand, US, and a grouping of others, basically saying, well, look, we already have agreed rules here. And where we think we're seeing that those rules are being traversed by certain countries, it's important that we do call that out and highlight it to ensure that everyone, other countries are aware and understand what that activity looks like and can protect themselves from it and engage in the international discussion in an important way. Now, when you referenced, you know, I pull back personally from the, you know, if we're talking about cyber warfare, we would be talking about a very distinct loss of life situation. Correct. And physical destruction. Correct. Of you know, and that's not what we're talking about.
I understand. I was speaking. Let me stress that I was speaking hypothetically, not about anything that's happened.
Sure.
Because at the outset, you said this UN group of governments agreement on the principles was that international law, existing law, translates to the cyber world. So, recalling something like 9/11 being described as an act of war, right? Were an attack like that to be the result of some kind of cyber operation, we would clearly be in the realm of talking about acts of war. The reason that I raise it is that we've been speaking theoretically about cyber warfare, in inverted commas, for a long time. The reality is that it has the potential to be, clearly the potential to be, the theatre for acts of war or for conflicts leading up to that description, which would suggest an urgency in sorting out understandings, wouldn't it? And is there that urgency, not just by the liberal democracies, but by China, Russia and others?
Yeah, look, I think really important thing to say is that any solutions to the current environment in cyberspace at a state level, any solutions will absolutely have to involve Russia and China and those countries that we may not always agree with at times. That's a vital part of this because, you know, and what we work really hard on, I think, in that regard, and we are as an international community working incredibly hard on, is trying to get away, trying to create an environment where there is, you know, more confidence between countries in terms of, you know, a whole array of confidence building measures that we can build together, and trying to avoid situations which can become, you know, misinterpreted between countries and potential miscalculation could take place. And these are all terms that are often used in the arms control environment around other particular weapons types. And I'm not talking You know, I'm not saying this is a weapons type as such, but you know, these are important measures that we're taking, whether it be at the regional level or at the global level. You know, something that we have done in trying to create stability in cyberspace is, you know, talk about international law complementing norms, then look at how we can build other countries' capacity to be able to respond to these issues as well, because we also understand that, you know, the impacts of these kinds of incidents are going to affect potentially disproportionately those countries that aren't as well prepared. So an important part of creating cyber stability is through capacity building. But it's also about being willing to talk about in the international environment, if you like, what those limitations are or what it is that you do actually do. And something as Australia is, we published back in 2017 in our international engagement, cyber engagement strategy, you know, Australia's approach and its offensive cyber capability and what that means and what, if you like, the parameters are of that particular capability. And I think, you know, transparency measures are a way of creating more confidence between countries. And, you know, like we have done in many other areas in the past, it's important that we're talking about these issues. We're putting, you know, a bit of transparency around them so that we can draw up more certainty. But it's true to say that some countries won't talk about their offensive cyber capability. They won't even admit that they have an offensive cyber capability. And that makes that conversation very hard. So it's about, as groups of nations coming together and having an honest conversation and ensuring that we can protect what it is that we love about the internet architecture. And, you know, I know a while ago you did begin asking questions about the private sector, and, you know, necessarily we focus very heavily on the state level, but the private sector in all of this, you know, the private sector, a big ubiquitous beast. But it's true to say that a majority of the capability and infrastructure that delivers the internet that we enjoy and the digital connectivity that we enjoy rests with the private sector. And without them involved in the various discussions that we have, well, then we're not going to come up with the right solutions, whether that be in terms of cybersecurity solutions and sharing information between private sector and the various agencies that deliver cybersecurity, whether it be in looking at global architectures of how cyberspace is governed. You know, the origins of many of the different bodies that help govern cyberspace, it's a kind of quite a hodgepodge of different organizations. Many of those are private sector NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which have a great deal of agency in shaping what the internet architecture looks like. But, you know, even that is coming under strain from those countries that feel that the state should have a far heavier role in what internet governance looks like. So it's, you know, it's an incredibly complex picture. And as a group of cyber diplomats and more broadly, I would say it's becoming far more mainstream in our general diplomacy. We're trying to help navigate through that as best we can and as quickly as we can, because this whole environment is moving and shifting so quickly. That's the nature of technology.
It's also prompted, of course, by COVID, which has seen so much more of private and public sector operations migrating online. You've touched on, and you're alluding to something I would like to ask you about, because this is going to come down to the hard state diplomacy again. And that is, you were talking about some of the NGOs who run much of the architecture of the internet. And it was back in 2019, I think, that a Huawei-led group, China Mobile, China Unicom, Chinese Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, proposed a significant overhaul of the internet, and specifically a new top-down internet protocol called New IP. Now, we really are getting into the nuts and bolts of the infrastructure of how the internet works when we are discussing these things. And the question is, again, can Western liberal states expect to hold entirely the power over that infrastructure? Is it something they should be defending absolutely? Or is there going to be growing pressure for change that recognises the role of other countries?
Well, I think, again, a good question. I would argue that already, that we have a multi-stakeholder approach to the way that internet governance is produced, and that is a global discussion. It is inclusive, and I think it would be guiding us down in the wrong path if it was suggested for a second that it isn't, because that is a narrative that's put towards these groups that they are somehow not inclusive. They're not involving the broader groups, but they do, and they've been designed necessarily so that a whole range of countries can actually engage with them. I think, what you spoke about there, the proposal from particular companies, is it firstly shows you the power that the private sector can have within these various organizations. And I think you do see the redoubling of efforts from the global community in looking at, standards bodies in internet governance organizations to ensure that, we don't take for granted what we have. The internet has enabled the most incredible advancements for us all. That's worth protecting. It's a very different environment to that which it was in the 1990s, for example, which necessitates that we're all navigating through how we apply the law online. And, if we think it, a couple of 100,000 users back in the mid-90s to the point at which we are now, where it's, billions of users, almost 50% of the world's population connected. That's a very different environment to which it started. And, you even look at some of the original architects of the internet protocols and the Tim Berners-Lees of this world and Vint Cerf, and even they come out quite strongly in saying, it's a different environment now. We do need to look at how we're applying the law online. But I think we have an architecture that works. It does have resilience built in, and it's important that we as countries are engaging with that. I think the difference for diplomats is that perhaps traditionally diplomats are, and we as a diplomatic community are, incredibly used to engaging at that state to state level, and if you like, that's our comfort zone. That's the traditions of diplomacy. What this area of diplomacy necessitates is that you are also engaging with the very senior levels of tech industry, because they are very powerful, and they are going to have to be part of the solution as our nation states. So it's a very complex area of diplomacy to actually deliver effectively.
It's massive, but it occurs to me that it's almost going back. I'm trying to think of a similar technological revolution that had such widespread private sector and public sector implications that it required something special. And I'm thinking of the advent of nuclear energy, clearly transformative, clearly offered, and still does offer perhaps, so many things, extraordinary amounts of energy be provided to for world demand, while averting some of the negative consequences we're now dealing with, say by using fossil fuels, right? On the other side, you ended up with the capacity to have catastrophic weaponry by using the same technology. We're almost in the same level of transformation, aren't we? And perhaps not existential, but almost in the same level of transformation and requiring almost the same level of global response, which, for goodness sake, if it could happen somehow through the travails of the Cold War, could potentially happen again.
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I'd want to reassure your listeners that, we are working incredibly hard to try and traverse our way through through the conundrums that cyberspace give us. I think, It is hard to find a historical reference point in terms of technological transformation. And especially if you think about the current context, and it's to just, further complicate our conversation, which is, you know, we have cyberspace as the digital architecture that we know and love. But then there's a whole series of technological advancements that are building off either the actual architecture itself or the data that it produces. And so if you add not only, you know, the cyber questions that we have to answer, but then we have, the whole, you know, the revolutions and innovations that are going on just through cyberspace. If you add to that the technologies of, you know, advanced telecommunications, infrastructure, 5G, O-RAN, and, you know, obviously in the future, 6G networks, AI, quantum computing, blockchain, and a whole series of these technologies. Once you add the entirety of those together, and it's the fact that they're all beginning to mature at a similar rate, the kinds of transformations that we'll see are actually incredibly hard to predict. And I rack my brains trying to think of a good historical reference point too, and I struggle because it's revolutionary. And what we're seeing is that is shaping geopolitics quite directly. And that has been one of the biggest shifts, is how this range of technologies that feed off of or are part of the cyberspace infrastructure that's being created are revolutionizing how the 21st century economies and power balances are created. So, you know, it is an incredibly complex and difficult position, which is only growing in its complexity, which necessitates that, you know, increasingly, you know, I would say this, I'm in one of these positions, but, you know, all countries should have these kinds of positions who are grappling with, well, how do we go about dealing with this in the international context? How do we ensure that all of those technologies, which are going to have incredibly positive impacts on all our societies, remain positive impacts on societies, because we need to be shaping our global environment to ensure that those technologies are absorbed in the right way and you know, bring all those positive benefits without you know, any negative consequence. And that's it's one of those very difficult, complex issues that we have to grapple with inside modern government now.
Well, there's been centuries of diplomats endeavouring that in different situations, and good luck with yours. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much, Catherine. It's been a real pleasure.
Dr. Tobias Feakin is Australia's inaugural ambassador for cyber affairs and critical technology.